Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.
53106 is our text number. That will cost you 30 cents. You are listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. Once again, as is always the case on a Tuesday, Jonathan DeBurka-Butler joins us to talk about some stories from some other parts of the world. Jonathan, good afternoon to you.
Sean, how are you getting on?
So, Israel versus Ben and Jerry's.
Yes, Israel has warned Unilever, who acquired Ben & Jerry's a number of years ago at this stage, that it is considering a legal response versus its subsidiary Ben & Jerry's, who of course are famous for making their wonderful ice creams. I don't know what your particular favourite flavour is.
Or so hard to choose.
So hard to choose. But anyway, this particular announcement that Ben & Jerry's made last Monday has left a bad taste with the Israelis, because they have said that they are no longer going to sell their products in what are recognised by the international community as the occupied territories in Palestine, okay? Mm. And the Israelis obviously are very unhappy about that, right? So it's actually gone all the way to the top, right? Because I suppose this is very much connected with the whole BDS movement. That's the boycott, yeah, divestment and sanctions movement.
Just be clear, they're not going to sell in the occupied territories, but they are going to sell in Israel.
Well, that was the thing at the end of it. Yeah, exactly. So as I said, this has gone all the way to the top. The new Prime Minister, still have to get used to it.
Yes.
Naftali Bennett spoke to the Unilever CEO, Alan Jope, over the phone, and he said that it was a glaring anti-Israeli measure, right? So he's getting involved, and even the foreign minister got involved. Israel's ambassador to the USA has been in touch with several state governors, urging them to, you know, do their part. Mm. There are shops in New York, which of course has, you know, areas that would have, you know, very close links to Israel, who are basically stocking the product and aren't selling it anymore. So there's a kind of a boycott and a counter boycott, I suppose, type thing going on here. But as you said, the company will continue to sell the ice cream in the rest of Israel, okay, through a different arrangement, as per their quote. So while on one side it might seem that they're making a very worthy move, on the other side you might say, well, you know, you're not necessarily going the whole way and stopping the sale of it within the whole country.
It would seem to be a move that hurts Palestine and Palestinians more than it hurts Israelis.
Well, you know, your point there is, in a weird way, quite well made, because this is what people who are critics of the whole BDS movement say. You know, the crux of that particular movement
what I mean is, if it was the other way around, if they said we won't sell into Israel but we'll continue to sell into Palestine, if that was physically feasible, you could see the logic of that.
Yes, I suppose, in a way, but I suppose they're making the point about the Palestinian territories and that kind of thing in a strange way. But I hear what you're saying. But that is a big thing about the BDS movement, and why some people are critical of it, because they say that, you know, the crux of it is that they don't want people in the occupied, who work in the occupied territories and produce things for Israeli companies buying there, right?
Yeah,
so that's what they're saying. Now, that's not connected with Ben and Jerry's,
sure,
but an awful lot of the critics would say it ends up hurting Palestinians. Even some Palestinians themselves say that. But that's what's going on. In terms of Israel considering a legal response, I don't really know what kind
on
of legal response
they
can take. And so far, they're just, lobbying various different governors that'll be sympathetic to them. The State Department in the United States have basically avoided giving a direct statement on that issue, but they said that they're really not into the whole BDS movement and that it unfairly singles out Israel and yada, yada, yada.
Yeah,
so everybody's just playing their part, as usual, you know?
And Unilever, though, seem to be sticking, because, you know, you could see, like, Ben and Jerry's as a company may, you know, be affording to have, you know, principles on these kind of things. Unilever is a big, huge multinational that probably doesn't care.
That's a good point. When it acquired Ben and Jerry's in 2000, I think part of their deal was that Ben and Jerry's would keep their own independent board and they'd look after their own brand integrity and corporate missions
and all that kind
of stuff, you know what I mean? So they have free reign to do what they want on this, to be honest with you. So I haven't seen any statement from Unilever as such, and I think they're just saying, well, look, let Ben and Jerry's deal with that because we don't want our, you know, our dishwasher pads to be affected and the like, you know?
Interesting, though, that the Israeli government are reacting to this so strongly.
Yes.
And I wonder, is that kind of tied to the image of Ben & Jerry's in the US, because it's a very American brand and it seems very benign and apple pie and that kind of stuff. And, you know, this is maybe a step too far for them in terms of Israel's image in the US, that God, even Ben & Jerry's are saying something about it.
Yeah.
That's an interesting one, it must be said. Right, we'll move on to Kenya now, where an environmental activist has been shot dead.
Yeah, this is a well-known activist, Joanna Stutchbury, who was shot dead, I think it's a good 10 days ago now, actually. It was on a Thursday night as she was returning home to her house, obviously, on the outskirts of Nairobi. And she had stopped her car to clear branches that were blocking her driveway. Now, evidently, she suspected that they had just fallen down in front of her driveway, but it would appear from further investigation that they were put there, because when she got out of her car, she was shot 6 times and subsequently died. When authorities came along, they looked at the car, they noticed that nothing had been touched. So nothing had been taken. So that ruled out a kind of an armed robbery, that side of things. And she had been very vocal in her opposition to attempts by powerful local businessmen who were unnamed. And I've looked at other reports in local TV, and it seems to be that, you know, people who knew or know who these people are, but they're not going to say the names. And one particular person who was close to her and also was an environmentalist said that they were connected to the government. All right. So these are powerful people. She had received threats, and obviously somebody has followed through on those threats. Now, her main issue was the protection of a forest that was on the outskirts of Nairobi. It's called the Kiambu Forest. And in recent years, because land prices had increased in and around Nairobi, this area was becoming very desirable for developers. Okay. And she had come across illegal activities in the area involving developers. She had flagged with the authorities, received threats, and unfortunately, this is the result.
Has this kind of thing happened before there?
It sure has, and it's been happening increasingly in the last number of years. There was a well-known American conservationist, a man by the name of Esmond Martins, who was stabbed in 2018. Now, his thing was looking after the ivory trade, or trying to put a stop to the ivory trade, and he was very successful, but he was stabbed to death in his home in Nairobi. I don't think anybody's been brought to justice on that.
Mm.
You know, that's what, 3 years now, and still it goes unresolved. So the hopes that this will go, you know, to court are kind of minimal. And again, in those interviews that I saw, most of the activists were basically calling on the president to get involved and you know, oversee the investigation.
Because there would be a suspicion that perhaps some local politicians might be in certain people's pockets.
That is what it was that I picked up from those TV interviews.
Mali, we're going to go to you next. Similar story, I suppose. The president, or the interim president, has survived a knife attack.
This guy is becoming increasingly interesting character, and we could see him around for quite a long time. This is Colonel Assimi Goita, who came to prominence back in August of 2020, right, when he led a coup against the then President Ibrahim Keita. Okay, so Mali's been going through an awful lot of trouble in the last 8 or 9 years, starting off with, you know, wars in the north of the country involving the Tuareg, and then there was a vacuum in Islamic State in the Levant, I think they called themselves there, got involved. So there's been a kind of an insurgency that the government have been fighting there for the last 8 or 9 years. The French have got involved, and it's spread across the region. So people are looking at Mali and sort of saying, well, look, you guys haven't sorted this out, and now we're all dealing with your problems, basically. So and it's drifted down into towards the capital, Bamako, as well. So the army came in August of 2020. They got rid of Keita. They put in an interim civilian government, and then they got rid of them in May. And he, from going from being vice president, has made himself president, and everybody, a lot of his mates have a lot of the top roles. So in doing that, he's obviously created quite a few enemies, and one of those enemies had a go at him last week, I think it was, on Tuesday of last week, at a mosque of all places, right, when an imam was directing everybody out of the mosque. This man lunged at him with a knife, blood was spilt, and it was all very dramatic. This man was then taken away, brought into custody, and subsequently died in custody.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which makes it even more, you know, frightening, I suppose, and underhand.
It would seem to imply, though, that it was well, I don't know if it was a spontaneous attack, but certainly not a very planned out attack, that, you know, he may have been just a lone individual who decided to
do this. It's funny, because before I came in, I had a look at this to see could I find out a bit more about him. The only thing we know about him, they're not releasing his name. They said that when they brought him to jail, that his medical condition deteriorated and he died subsequently. We didn't know what his medical condition was.
In the first place,
he wasn't processed. And he was a teacher. That's all we know about him. And he was a young man wearing blue jeans and a white t-shirt. That's all we know. So nobody knows anything about him. And he might well just disappear. And at the same time, this president, and we all know the power of propaganda, has survived an assassination attempt, you know, therefore garnering sympathy and everything that goes with it.
Right, we're going to, devastating news for, more devastating news for Boris Johnson, now that the highly valued Equatorial Guinea embassy has closed. Why have they closed their embassy there?
Yeah, they've closed their embassy because the UK have decided that they're not going to allow their vice president into the country anymore. Now, the vice president is a 53-year-old Theodorian Obiang, and he is an extremely wealthy young man. He happens to be, as well as being the vice president, he's also the president's son.
Yes.
Now, Teodoro Obiang is the longest serving president in the world. He's been there since 1979. And he got into power by taking it from his own uncle, putting him up against a wall and shooting him, right? Now, this country has a population of about 1.3 million people. It has lots of oil. Last year, it spent twice as much on its defences than it did on its education. And most of its population don't have running water.
So I once heard a statistic that they have one doctor for every 250,000 people.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. Yeah, wouldn't surprise me at all. And most of the money that they get from the oil goes to the Obiangs.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And now, is this son the one who was living in Miami, wanted to be a rap artist?
The very
point.
One. Yeah. And the one, the last time we spoke about him, he was in trouble with the French because there was a dispute over his 100 million euro mansion on the Avenue Foch and his fleet of cars, which they took off him. And so if he goes back to France, he'll be put in jail. They've thrown him in court in the UK now. Have followed that up, and they're basically saying, look, we know you're taking the state assets and you're using this to buy your own stuff. So he's got houses around the world worth about $500 million. He has Michael Jackson's diamond glove from the Bad Tour. He owns that and lots of other things. So he's a no good individual, you could say, and various different countries are shutting him down and closing down his assets.
Right. Okay. So the fact that the British have imposed sanctions, I assume many other countries are imposing sanctions on.
Well, I'll be honest with you, the only ones that I know of are France and the UK.
Yeah.
At this point, I assume the United States would probably do that.
Oil.
Yeah. You never know. It's true enough, I suppose. But that's where he's at the moment. So because of that, the government of Equatorial Guinea have said, well, we're not taking this, so we're shutting down our embassy in the UK. And that's the end of that.
Sierra Leone, we're going to next, where has the death penalty now been abolished or about to be abolished?
Yeah, it's the lawmakers in Sierra Leone voted on Friday to abolish the death penalty. And so I think it kicks in straight away. Now, there's the what's on paper and what happens in practice. So there hasn't been an execution in Sierra Leone since 1998 anyway, all right? Though you could argue it went through so much turmoil between 91 and 2002 with its various different civil wars that there was plenty of death around anyway. And the death penalty had been in the constitution since 1991, all right? And it was used for the usual things, aggravated robbery, murder, treason, mutiny, that kind of thing. And when there was a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2006, they had discussed getting rid of the death penalty, even though at that point it hadn't been used for 8 years. But they finally decided now that they are going to do away with it. And I think it's a funny one because two other countries have recently done the same thing in the region. Malawi got rid of the death penalty earlier this year, and then I think it was Chad last year that got rid of it. So it seems to be a trend that's happening. The number of sentences that have been handed out have gone down, and the number of executions have gone down quite significantly as well. So there was 25 executions in sub-Saharan Africa in 2019. It's gone down to 16 in 2020. So it's a good news story, to be honest with you. Certainly good news for the 99 people who are on death row as of today.
And, it might be good news for Peru, depending on your point of view, but they finally have a president.
Yeah, this is a top-up on a story that we did about a month ago, and I kind of can't believe it because it took them this long to actually declare the winner. This is the ongoing saga between left-wing candidate Pedro Castillo, who finally was declared the winner against Keiko Fujimori, the famous Fujimori family, who are the most... unbelievably gripping political dynasty in the world. You could really make a Netflix series out of them. They're an amazing family. But this was Keiko Fujimori's third attempt at running for the presidency. She of course, the daughter of the famous Fujimori, Alberto Fujimori, who's in prison now. And she lost by 44,000 votes. She's a very unlucky lady. She didn't want to give it up, but eventually the commission that looks after the elections basically declared the winner. They threw out all of her complaints about the election and that kind of thing. And Castillo is now going to be in from tomorrow, actually, for 5 years.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So, and was there any particular platform he ran on?
Yeah, it was. I think he had a mantra, which was basically a rich country for everyone and not just for rich people. So he was kind of talking about, you know, trying to get rid of corruption, which again was focusing on Fujimori. And in fact, probably one of the reasons she ran, not just to become president, but to avoid a probe into corruption charges against her, which is now going to probably go ahead, that she doesn't have presidential immunity. So
she's accepting the result, though, is she?
She is, because she's a Democrat, but she's not accepting it from the point of view of she was a bit of a sore loser, has to be said. And she has said that, OK, I accept it because I'm a Democrat and the truth will come out one day anyway. So it'll be fine.
OK, that's a bit.
So she's not going to go away, definitely. I mean, she's been around for a very long time and she hasn't reached the Holy Grail yet that she wants to. And she will try and go again if she's not in jail.
And I suppose Prue is an example of what we forget about when we're arguing about what should reopen and when. Like, they're in the grips of an awful pandemic still.
They are, and I think they are they have the most deaths in the world per capita, as far as I know.
Wow.
And an awful lot of their population, if I'm not mistaken, have been vaccinated, in fact. And it's they're still in the grips of real problems there. Yeah, absolutely.
I think a lot of that's to do with medical resources really, rather than anything else. The US we're going to go to finally, and as another violence-related story of a sort, Billy the Kid's gun.
Yeah, Billy the Kid's gun is going up for auction, and that was announced. I don't know when it's happening, but it was announced by Bonhams on Wednesday. So this is Pat Garrett's Colt single action revolver, is expected to fetch somewhere between 1.7 million and 2.5 million. So it'll probably go much higher than that, to be honest with you, the way things are at the moment. So yeah, Billy the Kid was gunned down in 1881, and he was just 21 at the time, I believe. But yeah, that was the gun that was used against him, and it was owned by a family, Jim Earl, I believe, and Jim has a collection of guns. He passed away, and the kids have basically said, come on, time to get the money. And they're putting it up for sale. So that's what's going to happen.
That's quite extraordinary. And his real name was Henry McCarty.
Yeah.
You never knew that about Billy the Kid.
Yeah, he's an interesting guy. Orphaned at 15, first arrested for stealing food, and then just got into lots of trouble, managed to escape jail a couple of times. And then Pat Garrett finally caught up with him and gunned him down.
Right. Now, what should we look out for over the next week or so?
Yeah, speaking of Peru, it'll be a great start for Pedro Castillo, because he'll be celebrating 200 years of independence the day after he's inaugurated. So that's handy for him. Nice little pep in his step for that. And then on Sunday, we'll see the start of World Breastfeeding Week. So that there were the two big things that I picked up on this week. That's it.
No pun intended. You worked into that one. Jonathan, thanks a million for coming into us. Jonathan DeBurka Butler there. We're going to take a break after that, taking paternity leave.
Moncrief on News Talk.
Brought to you by Avant Money. Think you're getting the best value from your bank? Think again.